Air Talk TKO. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us as we focus on the challenge of COVID-19 and the public health measures to try and control the novel coronavirus. With us today, epidemiologist, chair, and professor of UCLA Fielding School of Public Health's Department of Epidemiology, Karen Michaels. Dr. Michaels, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Let's begin with the conversation that we were having about the potential for opening public schools this summer, Orange County and their Board of Supervisors with guidelines for reopening. Your thoughts about trying to look forward here over the next couple of months and trying to push toward reaching that goal?
Yes, I think it's challenging, as you mentioned, because you have to ensure that the classrooms are big enough to seat students 6 feet apart. They have to wear face masks. And as you pointed out, the most challenging thing is probably the breaks where the students want to reach out to their friends. They're going to be closer together. They're gathering together in groups. So all of this will be a main challenge. So, of course, you know, August is still some time off, and we don't know where the pandemic is going, but I do think it's going to be a big challenge.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about one of the reports we have that a hospital in Wuhan province in China reporting about, you know, COVID-19 getting into the air filtration system, the air conditioning of the hospital, and then measuring it there. People are very concerned about the airborne potential for spreading the virus, whether it's in droplets, the virus potentially being aerosolized. Can you talk a bit about what we know and what we don't know about airborne spread?
Sure. And in fact, I was going to mention when you asked me about the schools, you know, no air condition in the classroom. So it's interesting. We, of course, know this is an airborne disease, so it spreads from person to person in droplets. Now, the question is, how big do these droplets have to be? So, you know, when you cough, the droplets are bigger. And if you have a wet speech, the droplets are maybe a little smaller, but still bigger than they usually float around in the air. So the big question now is, if these small particles that float around in the air after a person who was infected, was in a room, these little air particles or aerosols, these tiny parts that are going to be present for probably a couple of hours if you don't air out the room by opening the window or something else, then these little droplets, can they actually infect a person? Is there enough of the virus material, yeah, the RNA in there to infect a person? And we don't know that. Now, it is very likely, though, that you don't need a cough or a wet speech to transmit the virus. It is probably transmitted via the air in small particles, but we don't know how small is enough for infectious. Just think about it. You know, how many people in the world are infected? Not everybody coughs all the time. You know, it can't be only the cough. So there must be other ways of transmission. And we know there's other ways of transmission, like the surfaces and things like that. But as to your question to the air, we don't know how small the droplets can be, but it is very likely that if somebody who is infected was in the room, especially in a patient room in a hospital, that this air will contain the virus for quite a while, as they figured out, for a couple of hours, and that we have to be very careful there.
So when you mentioned air conditioning in the schools, you think it unlikely that the schools would be able to operate their air conditioning?
They shouldn't be operating their air conditioning while the students are in session, because you're pushing around the potential droplets, you see. And that makes the droplets fly further than the 6 feet.
So that's right there. You know, for some districts that are in very hot areas, that may be a deal breaker for them opening up over the summer right there if they're not going to be able to operate AC. So Do we learn anything by looking at nursing homes and how vulnerable residents have been there? Now, we understand, of course, that because of their age and infirmity, that they're vulnerable anyway. But have we learned anything about the nature of the spread by looking at nursing homes?
Well, I mean, there are, as you say, that's a very different situation than, for example, in the schools. You know, kids are supposed to be less susceptible even to this virus. And there is a lot of studies going on that. So I think that's a little bit apples and oranges. But in terms of the transmission, I think the problem, of course, in these elderly homes is that you have to provide a lot of assistance to the elderly. So you have to support them when they walk. So, you know, you can't keep the physical distance mm-hmm. between people as much as you can in the general population. And of course, that has also been a big risk factor in these elderly homes. And you know, you have to support them with so many different things of their daily lives, getting dressed, et cetera, et cetera. So you just can't keep the distance.
We're talking with Karen Michael. She chairs UCLA Fielding School of Public Health's Department of Epidemiology. She's also a professor there. And we're talking with her about what we're learning about the spread of COVID-19. What are epidemiologists learning about how the virus has spread in other countries?
Well, you know, every country takes this in a different way. They have different strategies. They have different measures. Some are very strict. As we know, the Asian countries are very strict. They have contact tracing in place. Some other countries, like, for example, Sweden, is very relaxed. They rely on herd immunity. But some countries have been extremely successful. And these were the countries that acted very, very quickly. Like, for example, New Zealand. They closed up very quickly. They had very strict measures. They have contact tracing. And now they are almost ready to come out. They have very few cases. They have very few deaths. They were really on the ball there. But they're also a smaller country. So, you know, sometimes the size of the country also makes a big difference.
Also, are they potentially more vulnerable, though, once tourism is such a huge part of the New Zealand economy, once people start flying again to New Zealand, are they at potentially greater risk down the road because they had such low exposure this time around?
Potentially, but I think the whole traveling issue is a challenge by itself. When can we go back to travel normally? I think this is going to be a huge problem. You know, sitting on a plane, flying somewhere is going to be a challenge. Staying in hotels is going to be a challenge. So I think the traveling will be really going back to at least reasonable travel is going to be challenged anywhere in the world. But yes, countries that rely a lot on tourism, like New Zealand, Switzerland, where people go for skiing, you know, these countries, of course, are more concerned, and they are really considering when should they open their borders for tourists to come in. Austria, for example, where they are also going to relax some of their very strict measures that they have, and they're doing pretty well. They are already considering when are they going back to tourism, when can they open up for people to come back. It's a very popular destination for skiing and hiking. So I think countries are going to be very cautious to open up, to let tourists come back in and reoperate resorts and hotels. But, you know, I think it's gonna take a little while. But yes, you're right. I mean, of course, they're more vulnerable.
So the hope has to be that when that time comes, that there are more therapeutics available, that testing is better, and that we're closer to a vaccine. I mean, that has to be the hope of these countries, right, is that if they do face it down the road, they'll be better prepared than they would have been this time around.
Yes, in particular the vaccine, or get people immune by, you know, we don't know how many people are infected, right? So I think we have a big challenge there to resolve. But if, in fact, a lot of people are infected and are asymptomatic and develop immunity, that would be good news. But of course, right now, we don't even know whether people get immune by having been infected. So I think, you know, we have still a lot of unanswered questions. The vaccine, of course, and an effective and safe vaccine would be the best option, much better option than treatment. You don't want to have people treated when they go on vacation, you know. So once we are near a vaccine, or we can provide a safe and effective vaccine to the majority of the population, we can envision going back to normal life, hopefully.
Karen Michaels chairs UCLA's Department of Epidemiology at the Fielding School of Public Health. Before I let you go, I want to talk about contact tracing, because we're going to get into the technology and privacy issues of that in just a few minutes. But I want to start with you talking about sort of how contact tracing is done now by public health departments. When someone is ill with a communicable disease, what are the ways that they determine the individual's contacts?
Now it's done by interviewing the person who they have been in contact with over the past, depending on the disease, over the past week, for example, couple weeks. So this is a very labor-intense process. First of all, the person has to remember who they have been in contact with. And of course, oftentimes that's not possible because you were on a bus, you were sitting next to somebody who you don't know. So, you know, how do you find those people? The other challenge with COVID-19 is that, as I mentioned earlier, probably half of the people who are infected never develop symptoms. So that's also a challenge, you know, to implement this contact tracing the good old manual way in COVID-19. But the traditional way is to try to contact everybody that the case names or lists for you, to the extent that they can. And then you trace down those people and you ask them to self-isolate.
And if you're dealing with, one of the big examples I think of is HIV, there you're, because that's not a casual contact transference, there it's probably easier for people to remember what sex partners they've had, who they've been intimate with, than COVID-19, and people are going to the supermarket, gassing up their cars. There are all kinds of potential, you know, passive ways of passing it on.
Exactly. And especially now that we anticipate that you can probably also spread the virus by just touching a surface and then somebody else is touching the same surface after you, that makes it even more challenging.
Karen Michaels, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it so much. From UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, chair and professor in the Department of Epidemiology. Coming up on Air Talk, we're going to be focused on this issue of contact tracing and some of the new technology using smartphones to try and do it, and what the privacy issues are people being notified of those contacts with someone who's been exposed to COVID-19. We'll take your questions as well at 866-893-5722. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, and on your smart speaker. Back in 90 seconds. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, on smart speakers all over Southern California, and the KPECC app. We continue talking about the challenge of contact tracing for those who are ill with COVID-19 to try and determine who those individuals could have potentially spread the coronavirus. With us is tech reporter, senior writer for Wired, covering security, privacy, and information freedom, Andy Greenberg. Andy, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Very glad to be here. Thanks.
So what are the technological options available to try and determine who people have had contact with?
Well, we're talking about contact tracing with smartphone apps, right? And there have been lots of proposals about how to do that. Some of them have gone so far as to say we should be tracking people's GPS and following them around to see where they share, you know, locations with other people or potentially infect them. But the proposal that I think really matters the most right now is the one that comes from Apple and Google, who are offering a change to their mobile operating systems, Android and iOS. And they're not going to be tracking locations. Instead, what they're offering to do is to give apps built by healthcare agencies access to the Bluetooth radios in your phone. And then your phone will constantly be sending out these rotating codes that other phones will listen for. And if you're ever in the same place as someone within 6 feet, say, for a certain time limit, so let's say if you're in the same spot for 10 minutes, then your phones will exchange these codes. And if one of those people later is diagnosed with COVID-19, they can hit a button on their app, declare that they're infected, and then their codes will be uploaded to a server, and then that server will tell all the other phones the codes of that person for the last 2 weeks so that their phones can match those codes and say, oh, look, I was in contact with an infected person sometime in the last 2 weeks, and then they'll get instructions about how to get tested or self-quarantine.
Would there be more specifics, Andy, for where the contact might have occurred so that, let's say it was at a supermarket, that the person would be notified and they'd think, yeah, but I didn't really come in close contact with him. And it's, they could sort of process how much weight to give that message.
This is an interesting sticking point. I think that Google and Apple have not been explicit about saying that apps should not tell you when in the last 2 weeks you came into contact with someone. Your app could tell you that if the app is built that way. And this is going to come down to how these healthcare agencies, probably at the state level, in fact, decide to do this. They can tell you this is the time that you were, you know, came into contact with someone, or they could just say sometime in the last 2 weeks you came into contact with someone. And regardless of when that was, you need to start to take precautions like self-quarantining. And I've heard different proposals from different app makers, like an app called COVID Watch tells me that they would just tell you that you were infected sometime in the last 2 weeks. Another app called CoEpi, standing for epidemiology, I think, is proposing that instead they could tell you something about when, in fact, you came into contact, which could have privacy implications.
Yeah.
You might know who infected you, potentially.
Yeah, and that could have a negative effect on that individual. Have other countries implemented this kind of smartphone contact tracing so far?
Well, Google and Apple's system is just coming out now in the sense that they've released a beta of the feature in phones so that developers can start to test it. So none of the other countries that are doing this have had access to that yet. But we've seen Germany, France, the UK, Australia, Singapore all talking about doing this. But mostly what they're proposing is a system that's quite different from what Apple and Google have proposed. These government agencies actually want to collect more information. They want to know who is coming into contact with whom so that they can reach out to them and warn them. As I think probably Karen was talking about, this is how contact tracing often works. But Apple and Google are proposing a system where really very, very little data, in fact, no data leaves the phone of the vast majority of users. They're just warned on their phone and they get to decide what to do alone.
We're talking with Wired senior writer Andy Greenberg. Also joining us is attorney Stuart Baker, who specializes in technology law. He was assistant secretary for policy at the Department of Homeland Security back in the mid to late 2000s and general counsel for the National Security Agency back in the mid 1990s. Mr. Baker, good to have you with us again on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Be talking to you.
So your thoughts about this, and obviously there are privacy concerns, but do you see the pros as likely outweighing the cons?
I do, mainly for the reason that Dr. Michaels gave. We don't have good memories and of who we came into contact with, especially in a context where the virus aerosolizes. So using Bluetooth can tell us who we were close to. And if that person becomes turns out to have been infected, then it gives us an idea that we may also be at risk and that we should take action to minimize the risk to the people we love that we would be spending time with. So it has real value. The privacy issue, to be honest, of course there are privacy issues in a pandemic. No one wants to be told they have to lose their job, they have to stay home, they can't go to movies, they can't go to the beach in some cases. Those are all intrusions on our personal autonomy. I have to say, the idea that the health authorities who are trying to stamp out this infection might know something about who's been infected and when strikes me as the least of our privacy worries.
All right. And so you would want to see the government looped in on this information, public health departments.
This is always the way we've done it. And suddenly somebody in Silicon Valley says, I'm going to reinvent it in a completely different way. They really have something to prove. And there are very few public health authorities who think that having this made automatic and keeping the health authorities at a distance is a good idea.
We're talking with Attorney Stuart Baker, who specializes in technology law. We also have a researcher who's going to be joining us, a member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation's board, Ashkan Soltani, who will be with us on the program. We'll hear his thoughts and some of his concerns about looping government into this information on contact tracing with those who have COVID-19. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Much to come in the second hour, including a proposal to cap the delivery fees that delivery apps like DoorDash, Uber Eats, Grubhub, and the others charge restaurants for delivering to your door. San Francisco, I believe, has put such a cap in place. But could it have unintended consequences, not just help restaurants, but potentially have a downside for drivers as well as for restaurants themselves? We'll hear the pros and cons of that proposal for a cap. And also coming up next hour, Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro, talks about his mammoth public transit agency. He joins us regularly, and he has some real stressors that he and his staff are dealing with, the safety of their drivers as well as passengers. We'll talk about the extra cleaning buses and rail cars have to go through and the limited schedules under which many of the routes are now operating. That's coming up next hour, Air Talk, here on KPECC. We continue talking about the prospects of using smartphone and Bluetooth on smartphones to be able to have contact tracing so that an individual who gets sick with COVID-19 would be able to alert others who had been in close proximity during the past 2 weeks so that they could test themselves and understand that they might have been exposed to COVID-19. With us is researcher Ashkan Soltani, who is a member of the advisory board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the architects of California's Consumer Privacy Act, and former senior advisor for the U.S. Chief Technology Officer. Mr. Soltani, thank you for being with us today. What are your concerns about using the Bluetooth on smartphones as the source for tracing COVID contacts?
So thanks for having me. And I think that's the precise question is around using this technology for contact tracing. No one's arguing that contact tracing isn't an important factor, particularly in the later stages as we start to open up kind of our stores and our kind of economy once again. The issues, I think, currently with using not just Bluetooth as the protocol Andy described, but also GPS and other technology proxies for contact, is that they can be quite erroneous. They can, for example, generate false positives, such as you and I being in contact, even though we might be separated by personal protective equipment or separated by a wall. But more importantly, they can also yield false negatives, which is essentially not reporting when you and I have been in contact, even though perhaps we were closely in contact. And so the issues we're talking about here is around using an untested technology, which has privacy concerns, but also efficacy concerns, to make decisions about people's lives. And if those decisions are simply whether maybe you should stay at home, or whether people decide whether to get go to the doctor to get tested, perhaps that's not a big deal, although I suspect people will get alerted a few times and then start to ignore those warnings in densely populated areas. But the issues I have more concern with is making decisions, for example, when people choose to not get tested or when they choose to go back to work on account of the result of an app, even when they might have been in contact or are experiencing symptoms. And so I think it's that combination of the unexpected use, where we make decisions of who can return to work, who can maybe enter a supermarket, who can use public transportation, based on kind of untested technology, that gives me the biggest heartburn.
Well, and I'm not sure I followed that. So how would this in some way encourage people who test positive to go back to work earlier?
So people that don't have an alert. So, for example, PricewaterhouseCoopers is advertising a version of these apps for employers to use. And so you would essentially require your employees to install this app. And employees that have essentially are alerted that they might have been in contact with someone that has the virus would not be permitted to come back to work. They'd be required to quarantine at home and get tested. Whereas employees that don't have those alerts, employees that are essentially green from the perspective of the UK app, would be permitted to come back to work. So it's essentially providing kind of a false sense of confidence around this infection based on these proxies, which are things like whether you were in the same location as someone or whether your Bluetooth signal detected someone near you.
But even if there are inaccuracies, which there certainly would be, the question would be to what degree would they be accurate? Even with those inaccuracies, wouldn't members of the public and patients still be ahead of the game, better than having no contact tracing at all?
So the questions of efficacy are absolutely paramount. But the to your question, if the false negative rate is higher, then perhaps not, right? Perhaps, so when this app first rolls out, for example, adoption is going to be quite low. And even if we could mandate 100% penetration, we only have 81% of the population in the US using smartphones, which essentially would yield that in a best case scenario, if everyone were running this app or this tool, it would cover only 65% of people in the US in terms of, or 65% of the cases that of encountering someone with the virus, which means that in the early days, you're essentially relying on the signal, right? And to your point, it might be better than none, but I'm saying it might be worse, right? Because you're saying you're essentially getting a pass to go out when in fact you might have been infected or you might have been in contact with someone.
Stuart Baker, you want to quickly respond to that?
Yeah, I agree with Ashkan. You cannot rely on this to be sure you haven't been infected. No one should believe that. On the other hand, if you have been in touch with somebody who's using the app and you get a notice that induces you to move to a different bedroom and not spend time with other people in your house who are susceptible, and that saves them from infection, it's worth a lot. I worry a little bit about the false positives of people being told you've been in touch with somebody who's infected when in fact you weren't. And one of my recommendations on this is you actually need more data. Probably you don't need to give it to the health authorities, but you probably should turn on Google Maps and keep track of where you were. And you do want the health authorities to know, you know, what day the apparent infection occurred, so you can go back through your records. And if you discover, oh, yeah, I was at a protest or a church service in my car, and there were people all around me within 6 feet, but I'm not worried. I had my windows up. You could be more relaxed about it.
All right.
you can solve some of these problems with more data, and some of these problems by not treating the decision of your phone as the last.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you, Stuart Baker, Ashkan Soltani, Andy Greenberg of Wired. It's AirTalk on KPCC.